You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Coming to you live from Studio One here in London, this is Midori House with me, Thomas Lewis. On today's programme...
After listening to Hillary rattle on and on and on, I don't think so badly of Rosie O'Donnell anymore. In fact, I'm actually starting to like Rosie a lot.
We've all had a dinner guest who just couldn't take a hint, but Donald Trump took it to new and rather awkward levels at a charity dinner in New York City last night. We'll discuss the pitfalls of presidential dinner etiquette and much more too with Monocle's Andrew Tuck, Josh Fennett and Henry Rees-Sheridan. Also to come... Buckle up, we'll take a look at a new car with shareable locks aimed at driving the sharing economy. All that, plus we'll look back at this year's Frankfurt Book Fair and discuss why Monocle's latest issue, which hit newsstands yesterday, is all about Canada. That's all to come here on Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London with me, Thomas Lewis. Hello from Studio One. I'm Thomas Lewis and a very warm welcome to you to this Friday edition of Midori House. Well, my guests today are familiar voices here on Monocle 24. The editor of our edit section, Mr. Josh Fennett, is here. The producer of our weekly design programme, Section D, Henry Rees-Sheridan. And of course, Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. Gentlemen, a very warm welcome to you to the programme. Now, I'm sure we've experienced that awkward moment where a dinner guest just can't quite grasp the mood of the room. Well, as he so often does, Donald Trump took that concept a few steps further at a charity dinner last night, seated just a few seats away from Hillary Clinton.
Hillary is so corrupt. She got kicked off the Watergate Commission. How corrupt do you have to be to get kicked off the Watergate Commission? Pretty corrupt. We've learned so much from WikiLeaks. For example, Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight, in public, pretending not to hate Catholics.
Well, I think it's probably pretty clear who they were angry at there, Donald. Some awkward booing there accompanying Donald Trump's speech at the Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation dinner in Manhattan last night. Now, Andrew, as parodiable presidential candidates go, I guess Donald Trump has been a bit of a dream, you could say. From there, for you, from having seen bits of this today, was he funny himself, or did he just totally miss the point of this whole occasion?
Well, he certainly got home some jokes, and there were certainly moments where, you know, we must be careful not to take just a kind of liberal edit of this and listen to the bits we don't like. There were certainly jokes that got everyone laughing, and Hillary Clinton went along with the jokes. The trouble was, he veered off on a tangent, and he had that inability to kind of change track when the room went against him, and that was the kind of awful thing. But again, you know, the extraordinary thing about Trump is, and this is the thing we've been wrong-footed with again and again and again, it doesn't matter, because he will just walk away from that and say that's, you know, a bunch of, you know, liberal elite people shouting at the back of the room who didn't get my jokes out there, people like it. And you have to remember that what he's saying, even if it's not funny, is gathering around him still a large number of people who just like the fact that he sticks it to Hillary Clinton and says that she's corrupt again and again and again, and that she shouldn't be trusted. So in a way, of course, it would have been better for, you know, the TV and the radio to have him saying some funny things. But, you know, we just have to be careful, because in the end, he's not bothered.
I think the question is, quite interestingly, you know, when you look at, say, some of the North American commentary after the second debate, particularly sticks in my mind, that, you know, this suggestion was really that, you know, he's really, as you say, Andrew, sort of, you know, held his ground. He's digging into the strategy that has worked for him pretty well so far. But who's that appealing to? Is that just galvanizing the base, or is it spreading the message further? Now, some of these jokes last night, as you say, did land. Josh, for you, what kind of impression did you get from Donald Trump after last night's proceedings?
Well, I agree to Andrew's point that Donald will not think that anyone in that room would be one of his core supporters anyway. So it's about getting these sound bites to some extent. But one thing that I think he did do rather well is he's not been very good at taking criticism. Famously, in 2011, Barack Obama swatted him aside like a blue bottle at a picnic, saying, you know, how he changed the White House, and made quite a big criticism of him. And as the camera panned in on his face, he looked visibly annoyed, but he rolled with the punches rather well. So I think his ability to laugh at himself will be a really big personal gain from the evening. And he gets the sound bites, and he often puts it to people that, you know, everyone's against him, the media's against him. And hecklers in the room do play into that argument a little bit. And he did make one rather funny joke, I thought. He acknowledged that Melania had stolen Michelle Obama's speech, and used that as a case where the media loved it when she did it and hated it when he did it. So I don't know. I think that idea of being adversarial and having everyone against him may, as Andrew says, play into his hands. And he did laugh at himself a few times. So probably a bit of a big loss for Donald Trump in our eyes, but maybe in some portions of the country, not such a big loss.
I can't do Donald's accent, but we should probably just chip in with the actual line. He said, Michelle Obama gives a speech and everyone loves it. It's fantastic. My wife Melania gives the exact same speech and people get on her case. I just don't get it.
And there was quite a lovely shot of Melania herself actually laughing, seemingly pretty genuinely, kind of at that sort of quip. And, you know, that was quite a maybe side of Melania we hadn't seen before. I guess, though, Henry, it's about knowing your audience when you're giving presentations. Famously, Donald Trump was invited to an African-American church where he started tearing into Hillary, and the pastor of the church cut him short and said, you're our guest here. We didn't invite you here to have this kind of speech. You know, for you, how difficult is it in this big prism of presidential, you know, campaigns, when you've got 1,000 demands, 1,000 audiences that you're trying to court, how difficult is it, do you think, to sort of hone in to one of those audiences on a given occasion?
I think that it is more difficult when it comes to events like this for people like Donald Trump, by nature of the demographic, who generally attend these kind of highly publicised events. I will say that my sympathy were wholly lay with the poor cardinals who were caught in shot in the background when Donald Trump was delivering these jokes, because I always find that one of the most difficult positions to be in when people begin to say off-colour things is present, but not in a position of authority to actually dictate where events are going to go next. They're having to constantly gauge your visible reactions, not to offend anyone.
Is that a metaphor for you in this radio studio, Henry?
Not only
about the trajectory
that,
of the conversation.
Very literally, earlier this week, Josh, when you went into an unprovoked political rant during Section D Live, this was after the microphone's been switched off, and I had to try to mediate through gestures. So, it's certainly tricky, but frankly, if you've reached that station in the American political system, you should probably have honed those skills
and just the
slightly earlier.
I think the weirdest line was this thing when he said, you know, for example, she's here tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics. And no one kind of even knew what it meant. And it kind of went down very badly. And as Josh said, when you've got, you know, a group of kind of the leaders of the Catholic Church sitting around, they kind of don't know what to do with themselves. It leaves everyone feeling a little bit uncomfortable. But again, I come back to this fact that there's opinion polls today that put them as close as 4% apart, and say that, you know, she has lost some of the lead that she had when we had these shock revelations about his kind of, well, claims about his sexual past. So it's interesting. It's just too worryingly close, I think.
We focused on Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton gave her own remarks. She had quite a good joke, I thought, to start things off. She said, "I've come to this very important dinner. I've taken a break from my very rigorous nap schedule," which I thought was quite a nice sort of poke at her own expense. Andrew, how do you think Hillary Clinton did?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton did well, and I think that she's had a very good teacher in Obama. You know, Obama is a genuinely funny speechmaker. You know, when we see him trying to, you know, entertain journalists, or when he's at any of the kind of famous fundraisers, you know, he can be very, very funny. And she's been at many of those talks and heard him speak many times, and I'm sure she's gleaned something from him. And let's remember, these things are not casual affairs. These things have been rehearsed again and again and again. She knows exactly how these things work. And let's remember, she's not a naturally funny woman, you know, and that's not meant to be in any way a negative. You know, she's a serious woman who has found it harder to navigate that very torturous thing about being open, funny, engaging, talking about her family without being seen to play the woman card or be too light and frothy. So she knows it's an almost unwinnable game, and I think she did well.
I think it's so interesting, the shift that's sort of taken place about the way sort of people look at Hillary Clinton. You think when she was Secretary of State and that photograph of her in the big military plane with her sunglasses on became this kind of, you know, international sensation, people sort of doing their own takes of it, that kind of thing, and the sort of crowning of all of that was Hillary Clinton herself making a joke of it. And, you know, this kind of affection for her was kind of through the roof, really. And this was someone who was very serious, who's Secretary of State, but could also have a bit of a joke and a bit of a laugh too. And I suppose I can't quite figure out why, as a serving politician, people have these kind of great affections for her, speaking very broadly. But then as a candidate, it's just a totally different story.
I think she's been drawn into a game of muckraking, which she is really struggling to weather. So she made the point, the perhaps very honest point, that she spent 4.5 hours debating Donald Trump in the past 3 presidential debates. And these things are sticking to her a little bit. She does look a bit rattled. I'm not to disagree too much with you, Andrew, but I feel as if she has to constantly remind people of the hyperbole that Donald Trump is using and bring things back to a place of normal political debate, which most debates would start at. They would talk about the policies, knowing where the rules were. But Donald Trump has been swerving so far all over the road. She looks a bit exhausted, and I don't know if she's always got the answers. And inevitably, in the coverage, they talk about what she's wearing, which I think is always interesting. You know, she's wearing a fuchsia dress. That, you know, the New York Times article is at pains to point this out, and, you know, how nice she looks, which I think is an odd double standard, because they don't mention what Donald Trump's wearing.
Particularly
a big suit,
and
always.
They should do, because he always looks ridiculous in anything that he wears. I don't know where he gets his clothes made, but he looks an absolute tip.
And let's not forget, this was a Catholic dinner. Several men in the room were also wearing dresses that went uncommented on.
Okay. Now, she did have this good line. So she says, Donald Trump really is as healthy as a horse, you know, the one that Vladimir Putin rides around on. Which is quite a good line.
It's clever. No, it is a very good line. Henry, just...
And he didn't like it either.
But, you know, when the camera panned to him after these jokes were being made at his expense, he had this big sort of million-dollar smile sort of breaking across his face. His arms were very firmly crossed, you know, across his chest. But I thought, actually, you know, obviously there's a bit of gritting teeth, but you've seen some of these other things where he's, you know, had, you know, jokes at his own expense, that he has looked genuinely uncomfortable. I thought actually he seemed to be, in these off moments, kind of getting into the swing of it, really, you know. And Hillary Clinton too, I think.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah, he's good off the cuff. That's, you know, and let's give him that. You know, the trouble is, he's good off the cuff when he's got supporters in the room, because that's his skill, is smelling the blood and knowing, okay, I'm on the trail of something here. I can really go for it. They're whooping, they're enjoying it. And when he's against a neutral crowd or a mixed crowd, it was much more difficult for him to play the room. And I think that's why many of his jokes just kind of like collapsed, while others, you know, genuinely did hit their mark.
Henry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to jump in and say, yeah, and I think that the core of, or maybe the root of Hillary Clinton's unfunniness, and I agree with Andrew that I think she is a profoundly unfunny woman. I think that she has many other redeeming qualities, obviously.
And she doesn't need to be funny, but in the end.
I think it's rooted in the fact that she is so profoundly on the cuff in every single one of her utterances and movements. She cannot leave the cuff at any point, apparently. And I think that, you know, that's her safe zone. And, you know, as Andrew pointed out, she had some good lines yesterday, but they were so palpably kind of rehearsed and drawn up by, you know, a team of, you know, people who I imagine are kind of, you know, very, very well-briefed Ivy League graduates in her staff, that they did feel a bit stale even when they were formed.
Well, that's the same as Prime Minister questions here. You know, Theresa May trying to make her, you know, a funny woman. Nothing to do with gender. She's just not very funny, Theresa May. And they've tried to kind of, you know, wheedle some jokes into her speeches in Parliament. And she delivers them with a certain kind of aplomb. But they're not funny. And she's just not a funny woman. She should just get on with kind of, you know, wrecking the country. She's doing quite well already.
Josh, quick thought to you.
Political point there. We'll come back to that later. Yes. Maybe not.
Go ahead, Josh.
I'm not sure Barack Obama was ever particularly hilarious.
He's a good speech maker.
He's a brilliant speech maker, but he's increasingly become a media darling after performances at the correspondents' dinner at the White House, after teaming up with NBA stars and doing funny comedy shows throughout the US. This wasn't part of his 2008 election pledge. I'm going to make you laugh for the next 8 years. And I wonder if the natural charisma that he had then and the serious points that he were making, rather than the humour with the platforms on which he was elected. I mean, I didn't see him making too
many jokes. But do you think, I wonder if she also suffers oddly because of Michelle Obama? Because, you know, Michelle Obama, you know, she can get on the stage with a bunch of kids and do a great dance. She's funny. She has a natural inclination to put her arm around someone. Yeah, she has that kind of, you know, for want of a better word, that kind of Princess Diana approach where she, you know, she's not put off by sickness or poverty or difficulty. She seems to have naturally the instinct to know what to do in all of those situations and can be with anyone. Whereas Hillary Clinton, you feel, is a little bit kind of uncomfortable coming out of her zone.
But Michelle Obama's got no one going for her. I mean, people will be taking chunks out of her.
Oh, God, loads of people are going for Michelle Obama. Oh, yeah, the Trump people can't stand her. But, you know, there's plenty of people who don't like her. But what's interesting is when you see her as the most colourful Democrat, the woman who is in the press all the time, doing it effortlessly, it just makes it look even more difficult for Hillary, who's just that a bit leaden about the way that she does things. Even though I think we're all getting to the point for people like us, you know, is without a doubt the candidate we 100% want to win.
And it's quite interesting, you know, you look at the second debate, I think it was, when Hillary Clinton quoted Michelle Obama. Now, undoubtedly, Michelle Obama was sort of brought in the convention, for example, gave, you know, an absolute knockout speech at the opening day of it. You know, and the fact that Hillary Clinton is now quoting her, I think, you know, is an awareness that actually this is going to have to be a team effort, you know, from her point of view, and has been, I think that's been an awareness for some time now, because of this narrative of this kind of distance, this maybe sort of lack of sort of maybe a bit of discomfort, say.
While Hillary Clinton rather is failing to win the vote of many women, actually the support of Michelle Obama is crucial, because here you have somebody who, you know, obviously represents a wide spectrum of people. You know, it represents a black vote, a woman vote. And for her to be close to Hillary and to show her support for her, it means a lot. It delivers votes.
Just want to bring us back to the notion of dinner parties. We've all got a little glass of white wine here. This is not an awkward dinner party, but I guess...
Oh, we were keeping that secret.
Well, there we are. Cats out of the bag.
We were until Henry downed his second full glass.
I mean,
they were both
Friday
little.
Night.
You enjoy yourself. In fairness, you're like, I've not got my tumbler out.
Are you going to talk about getting rounds in? The etiquette of the round.
I'm a famed presence for my round buying, Andrew, as you well know.
It's not quite the place on a news show, but we did hear rumour that you were held down and your card extracted from your back pocket in order to buy the cheapest bar round ever because some pub was clearing out their £1 bottles of beer.
My generosity is fabled, thank you very much. I'll defend myself
fabled
another
in
day.
The sense that it's fictional.
let's bring it back to more serious matters. Josh, Well, you've just edited Monocle's latest book, A Beautiful Thing It Is. Inside, it's the Monocle Guide
that's
to Dining and Drinking.
That's got some etiquette about food and drink and orders.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. You have a lovely guide inside about the etiquette of dinner parties, what a guest should do, what a host should do. If you were advising, say, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton on this kind of dinner, what gems would you throw their way?
Very hard to advise them. They're obviously doing very... They're obviously doing different things. But the first thing I would say is to set up your dinner party in exact opposition to every principle set forward by the Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation, because it's a large, extremely formal dinner in which rumbling tummies could probably be heard throughout as miserable speeches were made by political campaigners. That's not how to do a dinner party. Get everyone fed, get everyone to have a few drinks.
Joke-free zone, is that what you're saying, Josh?
I've never understood that, because I believe that it falls into the broad category of roast format. Is that correct, the Alfred? It's kind of this bizarre American format where, under the guise of a dinner party, a fundraising event pits a famous person, or multiple famous people, against each other in a kind of weird
you're right, but there's always resolution to those things. I mean, you saw the awkward fake bonhomie about it being a kind of charity event, but at the end they shook hands 24 hours earlier. Let's remind listeners that they didn't shake hands after the presidential debate. You know, no one's saying that the hatchet's been buried, but under the guise of charity, this kind of bonhomie lets you say things and then lets you come back at the end and you know, figure out that it was all a joke. And that dinner party theme lends itself to that. There are no tips from Donald Trump or Hillary on how to host.
I know we're going to be talking about the way that society is shifting in a minute, but to do a story to do with cars. But just on this, just a small point. Do you think that people have dinner parties in the way they used to? Because, you know, like 20 years ago, when I was, you know, a bit younger than... Anyway, I was a bit younger. Let's not go into the numbers
then
game.
Donald Trump is
don't,
now.
Don't
let's
yourself,
not go into the numbers game, because it's going to reveal too much.
What year are you talking here, Andrew?
we're not talking like during the war, but it's a bit after that. But anyway.
First World War, yeah.
20 years ago, I think that there was a stage where you got to in your life where you thought, oh yeah, we're going to invite friends around for dinner. Yeah, it's easy. We'll cook for everybody. But I think that now, when I see people in the office who are certainly much younger than me, that the easy option is just to go out, because food is actually much cheaper than it was 20 years ago. That people would eat, would go out, you know, maybe every now and then. Going out for food was a kind of special thing, and now going out for food is so cheap that you kind of go out all the time. So why bother having a dinner party when you can go to a restaurant and you can gather everyone around the table and do your thing there, not have to cook? Do you think that the dinner party is dead?
Andrew, are you fishing for an invitation to Haringey Green Lane for a Turkish this weekend?
I'm not fishing for anything, but I just wonder, do you host a dinner party every now and then?
Yeah, actually. I think they still go on, but I think that the conventional etiquette of, as with so many other things, has kind of been partly forgotten and partly deliberately jettisoned. What do you think, Josh?
I completely agree with Andrew's point that when it's cheaper to eat out, and there's a lot more cultural cachet with, you know, going to a new place, and there's such an abundance in the kind of urban centres that we spend our time reporting and where most of our listeners are probably listening from. What I will say is that there's a kind of voguish rediscovery of cooking, in the same way that we're all discovering that we're able to grow beards and, you know, make rough-hewn whittled spoons out of wood. You know, we're rediscovering the craft of actually making.
What are you doing for an evening? Making spoons,
whittling sycamore spoons, and cooking, and rediscovering cooking.
He's the Welshman. He should be carving the old love spoons.
My collection
down there
of love spoons is fabled. I'll tell you that now. And on that note, perhaps we'll leave the dinner party behind. You can take us for dinner later, Josh. Thanks for the invite.
I'm afraid.
And we'll move on. As you mentioned, Andrew, we're moving from dinner parties to car sharing now. Now, if you're prone to losing your car keys from time to time, we might have found the car for you. Chinese automaker Geely has launched a new vehicle aimed squarely at the growing sharing economy market. Now, with shareable locks and an open platform designed to make its vehicles the most connected in the world, the new Lincoln Co brand will officially launch its first model, an SUV, next year. Andrew, what do you make of this model?
So I've just come back from Berlin this morning. I was at the launch of this car yesterday in Berlin, and they chose Berlin for a very deliberate reason. It's a city about kind of a little bit edgier, lots of tech people there, lots of innovative things happening, an entrepreneurial city, and they wanted to plant the car in there. So we went to this car launch. They didn't even show the car right until the very end. So all the elements were, there was food and drink, there was like entertainment, but they were trying to make sure that you were thinking about other things than just the car, because in the end it is just a car. Alain Visser, who came from Volvo, so Geely owns Volvo, and they're trying to make this new brand, Lynk & Co, L-Y-N-K and Co. The Co stands for community, for cooperation, for all sorts of things. They want to make this car something that will appeal to a more millennial generation. Now, it's an SUV, so actually I think the people who are going to buy it are in their 30s and things in reality, but they want to think that people in their 20s will start looking up this car. So they're doing two or three things, one of which is API is the kind of the way that you get into making programs and things for a car. So think of your iPhone. They're thinking of it as an iPhone on wheels. They're going to say, okay, it's open source. You make apps for it. You come and decide what you want this car to be. You personalize it. Even the dashboard, you can move all the kind of the icons around, make it like on your iPhone. And then the other thing is interesting. They want to build a car that is deliberately shareable. So there's a few things about it. One of which is that the key can exist on your smartphone. And so, for example, you can be you can get to work, and then you can send the key to several other people who can then just go and use your car during the day. You could potentially, you know, park your car at night, send the key to somebody who's, say, an Uber driver. They pick up your car for several hours, they make some money, they pay you a rent, you're earning money. So the idea is for people who feel guilty about having a car because they're millennials and got bicycles, they're thinking, okay, actually, this isn't so bad. It's being used all the time. Huge numbers of, you know, questions get thrown up. But what's interesting is whatever car company you talk to now, they're worried about the future. How do they engage with this audience? And I thought Alain Visser was really interesting in saying, I don't have all the answers. I don't know where this is going to go. I'm not saying this is the solution. And I can promise you, you don't need another car brand. But actually, we're giving you this because we think it's the beginning of an interesting way that car companies reimagine what they're doing.
Josh, just a quick thought from you on this. Do you think, you know, the sharing kind of economy for cars particularly, is that quite a canny move, do you think? What do you think that's been trying to be tapped into here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an absolutely brilliant idea. It's one of the very few juicy stories to come out of the car industry, which is obviously bound to older technologies, older fuels. And, you know, when Andrew talks about millennials feeling guilty, you know, just to extend that point, I think it's also cities needing fewer cars. So, you know, you need to motivate the consumer to want to buy it. Also, our cities face a kind of point where, you know, I might be in an office one day and I might get some batteries delivered by Amazon Prime. That's another car on the road. So, because cars spend so much of their time not being used, you know, it is a juicy story. It does have a juicy prospect. What I will temper it by saying is that I think the first one comes out in 2017. You made the point that, you know, people lose their keys. These things will lose their batteries. There needs to be an infrastructure in place to be able to charge these cars. Because actually, you know, if your car does lose its charge, you're worse off than not having a key because you can't even unlock it.
Yeah, but hold on. So just to dive in there. So the first car is a petrol car that will come out in China.
That's
the
right.
Second car is a hybrid car. And the third car could potentially be an electric car. But actually, even though that was one of the interesting things. I mean,
the locking technology.
Okay, sure, yeah, sure. But here's one of the interesting things, a side story to this. Speaking to them at dinner last night, they said, do you know what? The electric car, for the moment, is going nowhere. You know, we have such tiny sales. All it's like the iPad would be replacing every newspaper and magazine. It didn't happen. The electric car would sweep everything before it. We're still in this fossil fuel world. And this is what's interesting for all these car companies. The technology is actually as it was roughly when they started, the way that they sell cars. So they're going to copy the Tesla model, no dealerships, they'll sell direct. So all these things, it's just really funny how here's an industry, because it's about a big product, the second biggest thing you'll ever buy in your life after a house, it's moved at a glacial speed.
And that's another really interesting thing about it. I mean, clearly the idea of self-driving cars is absolutely everywhere. We're all discussing it. Lots of car companies are investing in it. It's a different way of thinking about it. And as I said, it's a juicy story because of that. There's so much that can be built around it.
In terms of different ways of thinking, smooth segue there, I think you'll agree. Into the final topic, Monocle's latest issue hit newsstands yesterday, and it's a Canada special. And what a fine thing it is. I feel rather sort of proud of having it in my hands, I'll be honest. Andrew, give us a quick sense of the motives behind sort of devoting the November issue this year to Canada in all its forms.
I'm going to try and do this in like 15 seconds because I think you have to say something. It obviously, one of the triggers is Trudeau coming to power, a rethinking of Canada, going back on the global stage. And as soon as you notice that's happened, you look at everything they're doing, from soft power to the brands they have, to the way that Canadians live, to their embracing of people arriving from around the world, to being a migrant nation. And it made us think this is an exciting place to look at in depth at this moment, and especially when you see what's going on just south of the border. But for you, you live there in Toronto, tell us.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a relative newcomer. I arrived a year and a half ago to Toronto, and, you know, very warmly welcomed since I arrived. And I think it was such an exciting opportunity for us at the Toronto Bureau to be able to dig in a little deeper. You know, I think people around the world have notions of Canada, but maybe don't really know the details or know the little surprises that are popping up everywhere. And people were so enthusiastic and excited that we were taking this entire issue of the magazine and just looking at Canada solely. And that enthusiasm, I think, was really, really exciting.
Just one bit on that. There's a really good story in there by Thomas Lewis about what happened when he fell over and broke his leg on the ice, and the love and warmth that you got.
I did get a lot of love and warmth. And on that note, some love and warmth from us here at Studio One at Midori House. That is all we have time for here today on this Friday edition of Midori House. Thank you very much indeed to my guests, Andrew Tuck, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and Mr. Josh Fennett himself. Midori House returns at 1800 hours London time on Monday. But for now, from me, Thomas Lewis, and Ben Rylan, and Antonio Hernandez, two producers today, thank you very much indeed for listening. Have a lovely weekend. Bye.